Chapter 8. The Buddha and Bodhisattva. Eternity and Time. The Bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, the will to achieve the liberation of all beings. This has been our constant theme. So far, however, although we have come across the distinction between the absolute Bodhicitta and the relative Bodhicitta, we have dealt explicitly only with the relative bodhicitta. Now, at last, we will take a look at the absolute bodhicitta, or at least try and catch a glimpse of it, or a glimpse of a glimpse. Everything we have seen so far must surely have given the impression that the bodhisattva follows a certain way of life. We have thought of the bodhisattva, or would-be bodhisattva, performing the sevenfold puja, developing the bodhicitta, making the four great vows, practicing the paramitas, and so on, living and working and unfolding more and more positive qualities in this way. In other words, we have thought of the bodhisattva as treading a certain path and aiming for a certain goal, the goal of enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. These impressions, though general, are perfectly correct, but correct as they are, there is a danger. Like so much of our thought and communication, these expressions, following a path, arriving at a goal, are metaphorical, and metaphors are not to be taken literally. They are suggestive, meant to stimulate or inspire, not to communicate in a clear-cut scientific fashion. The danger is that we may forget this and start trying to press them to logical conclusions. It is only too easy to think of the Bodhisattva's path in a very literal way, as though it leads up to Buddhahood, just as the garden path leads to the door of a house. We think that following the path will mean going along step by step until one day we reach the wonderful gateway of Nirvana, all glistening and golden. There it is, and we go in. It is very natural for us to think in this way, but it isn't really like that. When you come to the end of the Bodhisattva path, you don't find a gate or a doorway or any sort of celestial mansion waiting for you. You don't find anything at all. There's nothing there. The path just ends, and there you are at the end of it. In fact, you find yourself, to use another metaphor, which is also not to be taken literally, at the edge of a precipice. The path has gone on nicely, step by step, stage by stage, mile after mile. You have counted all those milestones, and you are expecting to arrive in comfort at the entrance to a great house. But no, you find that the path ends right at the edge of a precipice. So there you are, standing on the edge, and the drop goes down, not just a few feet, but what seems like miles. Somehow you know that it's bottomless, infinite. What are you going to do? The Zen people put it another way. They say that the spiritual life is like climbing a high and greasy flagpole. When, after a great deal of effort, you get to the top, you find that there's nowhere to go. You obviously can't go any further up. And you can't come down, because at the bottom there's a Zen master with a big stick. Nor is there a cosy little platform at the top of the flagpole on which you can settle down like St. Simeon Stylites. There's nothing there but empty space. And of course, you're too high up to jump. You can't go up. You can't go down, you can't stay there, and you can't jump off. What are you going to do? Well, it's quite impossible to say. The predicament arises out of the fact that path and goal are discontinuous. Contrary to our usual metaphorical mode of description, enlightenment is not reached by following a path. But this doesn't mean that the path should not be followed. Paradoxically enough, you follow the path knowing that it doesn't lead anywhere. Not even the right path will take us to enlightenment. The path, one may say, is in the dimension of time, while the goal is in the dimension of eternity. We will never reach eternity by going on and on in time. That is, one does not arrive at eternity by an indefinite prolongation of time, any more than one can arrive at a two-dimensional figure by the prolongation of a one-dimensional line. The two, eternity and time, the goal and the path, are by definition discontinuous, discrete. The Bodhisattva represents the dimension of time because the Bodhisattva path is followed in time. It's something that happens. It has a past, a present, and a future, and it doesn't go beyond time. But the Buddha represents the dimension of eternity. The Buddha represents the goal, and the goal is attained out of time. One reaches the end of the path within time, but one shouldn't think that one attains the goal in time. One attains the goal out of time, or, to put it another way, the goal is eternally attained. There are two ways of looking at spiritual development. It can be seen in terms of advancing from stage to stage, but it can also be seen in terms of deepening one's experience of what is already there. We need both. If one thinks one-sidedly of the spiritual life as a progression from stage to stage, one is liable to become too goal-orientated. But if one thinks only in terms of deepening one's present experience, unfolding from a deep centre within oneself, one may become rather inert. It is perhaps best to think of operating in both modes at the same time, or alternating between them at different periods of one's life. We have said that one follows the path, knowing that it doesn't lead anywhere. One also follows it with no guarantee that it is the right path. However, it is possible to resolve this contradiction and uncertainty by balancing the model of the path with the model of unfolding. Sometimes people are over-concerned that they have not got exactly the right teacher, the right mantra, the right book, that they are doing the right thing that will get them to the right enlightenment. In a sense, it isn't possible to know. If someone came along and said, "You are on the wrong path, you are definitely going to hell," what would you say? What could you say? You couldn't prove they were wrong. You don't know in that logical, demonstrable fashion. But is that sort of knowledge applicable or appropriate to enlightenment and the path to enlightenment? If it is possible to know that one is on the path to enlightenment, it can only be because there is something within one already, however embryonic, that corresponds to what is fully developed in the Buddha. Without that consonance, one could never follow the path or gain enlightenment. An unenlightened human being and an enlightened human being are both human beings, so one has something in common with the Buddha, and the Buddha has something in common with oneself. What one is trying to do is increase what one has in common, so that there will be less and less difference between the Buddha and oneself. When there is no difference at all, one will oneself be enlightened. All we can do is say, "Here I am, and there is the Buddha," or at least we have what purports to be records of a being of that sort. When I examine those records, I can see that I have certain things in common with the Buddha, and although he had those qualities to a much greater degree than I do, the teaching suggests that I can develop them. So, provisionally accepting that there might be something in these teachings, I will see if I can. For instance, this text says the Buddha was extremely kind. I can be kind myself on occasion, but I can see that I could be a lot kinder. Is it possible for me to develop more kindness? So we try, and we find that yes, it is possible. Then we conclude, well, if I can develop a bit more kindness, I can surely develop a lot more. And so we go on. It all comes down to one's own practice. There is no point in saying that one believes in the Buddha, even if the Buddha can be demonstrated to have lived, if one makes no effort to close the gap between oneself and the Buddha. It is a continuous refinement through which one becomes progressively happier and more integrated. And there will be something in oneself which insists that when one becomes more emotionally positive and more mindful, one is on the right path. When you feel healthy, no one can say, "Oh no, you're very ill." You know that you're in a state of health, at least if it lasts for a little while. In the same way, if you're full of friendliness and compassion and mindfulness, no one can convince you that you're on the wrong path. The natural self-transcending nature of the conscious being means that when you are all the time transcending yourself, you know that you are on the right path, because such a path corresponds with your innermost nature. Sometimes you may feel as though you are unfolding like a flower. At other times, spiritual life may feel more like climbing a mountain. The two modes correspond to the nature of the bodhicitta. The absolute bodhicitta is enlightenment itself, while the relative bodhicitta is the bodhicitta everlastingly in the process of attaining enlightenment. The two together are the ultimate realization. Thus, in our spiritual life, we are trying all the time to achieve that which we already have. We have to do both. Realize that we already have it, but at the same time go all out to achieve it. One without the other leaves us out of balance. We can get a sense of the possibility of combining the two from our dream life. Say, for example, you wake up with a memory of having been dreaming about travelling in India. At the same time, you are aware that this dream was really about painting a picture of a flower. Somehow you have to accept that the same dream was about both things. To your waking consciousness, they seem like two alternatives, but the dream experience was both, in a mysterious way that the waking consciousness cannot apprehend. The spiritual life is rather like that. You have to have a sense of racing forward all the time, moving from stage to stage, climbing that mountain. At the same time, you have to be absolutely still, just realizing more and more deeply where you are now. When you come to a point outside time, as it were, you realize that you have been there all the time. So when you have gained enlightenment, you realize that you were always enlightened. It is said that some Zen masters, on the attainment of enlightenment, just laughed and laughed, seeing how absurd it was that they had ever imagined that they were anything but enlightened. What a silly mistake! And a mistake on account of which they had suffered a great deal, completely unnecessarily. Even in ordinary life, we sometimes find that, after we've worried a great deal about something, we get some new piece of information which makes us realize that we didn't need to worry after all. Then it seems ridiculous to have been worrying so unnecessarily. The experience of enlightenment is an extreme version of that. You see what a fool you were, struggling and suffering, wrestling with imaginary problems, thinking you were this, thinking you were that. And now you can afford to laugh. What a silly Buddha you were. The 17th century Dutch philosopher Spinoza says, "God is an infinite substance with infinite attributes," and adds that of these infinite attributes, only two are known to us, space and time. According to Buddhism, it is because we perceive reality through these two fundamental modes of experience that we inevitably arrive either at a spatial or a temporal model of reality. All we can do is reduce the one to the other. There is no third mode by which we can reconcile the two. It would seem that reconciliation is possible only in our spiritual experience, above and beyond the level on which the contradiction, if it is a contradiction, exists. In that sense, this great opposition, or incommensurability, between space-type models of reality and time-type models of reality constitutes a sort of koan that can be solved only by an intuitive leap. When I use the term eternity, I am thinking of ultimate reality considered as transcending time, rather than as an infinite prolongation of time. In a sense, though, this is still misleading, because the word transcending simply invites us to imagine time and eternity as existing in space, while to speak of something as being beyond time is also to treat time as a form of space. One is continually brought up against the limitations of language in this way. So these expressions cannot be taken literally. One needs to try to see the point of them through meditation or in some other way. Even the most successful conceptualization is not adequate to reality. One still has to make that intuitive leap, though it is easier to make that leap if one tries to formulate as precise a conceptual idea of the truth of things as possible. We usually, and up to a point justifiably and correctly, think of the Buddha as a historical figure, and the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment as a historical event. To look upon the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment as occurring within the dimension of time is not altogether wrong, so long as we make it clear that we are speaking conventionally. But only too often we go on to think of Buddhahood itself as existing in time, and this is altogether wrong. Although the Buddha as a historical person may have existed within time, Buddhahood itself exists outside time, in the dimension of eternity. We can, in fact, think of the Buddha as existing simultaneously on two levels, on the level of time as a human historical figure, and on the level of eternity as reality itself. Then, in addition to these two, we can think of him as existing in an intermediate, as it were, archetypal realm. This brings us to what is known in Buddhism as the Trikaya doctrine, the doctrine of the Buddha's three bodies, as some scholars are pleased to call it. This doctrine, which is central to Mahayana thought and practice, has been much misunderstood. Trikaya literally means three bodies, three personalities, or three individualities. But the doctrine is not referring to three bodies, much less still three Buddhas. It is really describing one Buddha, or one Buddha nature, functioning on three different levels. In a traditional comparison, the Dharmakaya is likened to the pure blue sky without any clouds. The Sambhogakaya is a cloud appearing in the midst of this blue sky, surrounded by rainbows. And the Nimanakaya is the rain that falls from that cloud. Or, in Vajrayana Buddhist art, you get the three kayas depicted as Buddha figures, one above the other. The Dharmakaya is a completely naked Buddha figure, sometimes with a consort, sometimes single. The Sambhogakaya Buddha is a richly apparelled Buddha figure, crowned and adorned with jewels. And the Nimanakaya is our own familiar Buddha Shakyamuni, with his shaven head, his staff, and his patched robe. The Nimanakaya, the created body, or body of transformation, represents the Buddha as functioning on the human historical level, as subject to birth, old age, and death. This seems to have presented many of the Buddha's followers with a problem. Why should the Buddha be subject to old age and death? Even more problematic is the question, if the Buddha had so much compassion for the world, wouldn't he want to be reborn in the world? The Mahayana answer to that would be, how do we know he hasn't been? There are said to be Buddhas throughout the cosmos. How do we know that Shakyamuni was not reborn in some other world that needed his attention? This is the kind of answer that the Mahayana would give. Not very satisfactory, of course, but perhaps the question is not very satisfactory either. In a way, the question calls for the reconciliation of the difference between the Theravada and the Mahayana approaches. The Theravada clearly says, and this seems to be in the view of the Buddha himself, that on the extinction of his physical body, the state of the Buddha cannot be declared. It is one of the avyakrata vastunis, the unanswered questions. The question assumes that after the death of the Buddha's physical body, either he exists but is indifferent to the welfare of the world, or he does not exist. But the Theravada excludes both these possibilities by stating that neither does he exist, nor does he not exist, nor both, nor neither. The Theravada wisely leaves unanswered the questions that the Buddha himself would not answer. The Mahayana, attempting to be more enterprising, does try to answer such questions, although it does so entirely in terms of skillful means. It is important to remember that this is the working basis of the Mahayana. Too literal a reading of Mahayana texts can get one into philosophical difficulties. That said, if we take the Mahayana view that the Bodhisattva doesn't want to gain enlightenment for the sake of personal emancipation, but will come back again and again to help others, then the Buddha would presumably have the same attitude. Well, of course, the Mahayana, in, for example, the White Lotus Sutra, says that the Buddha only pretended to withdraw into his parinirvana. According to this text, the Buddha saw that if he continued to live among his disciples, they would become dependent on him, so he deliberately allowed his physical body to drop away. Can one imagine that the Buddha would not continue to be active in some other way out of compassion? No. He may have withdrawn his physical presence, but he must certainly be working in other ways, on other levels. Indeed, according to the sutra itself, there is a certain lofty plane where the Buddha is preaching the White Lotus Sutra all the time. The Buddha said that even in his lifetime, his nature could not be fathomed. Surely his nature, after the death of his physical body, is still more unfathomable. If you take the different traditions literally, there are all sorts of intellectual contradictions, but those contradictions have to be seen within a much wider, supra-intellectual, spiritual context. You can't say, though many Theravadins do, at variance with their own scriptures, that the Buddha is dead. But neither can you say, with some Mahayanists, that the Buddha is alive. Both statements go to extremes. The Sambhogakaya, literally the body of mutual enjoyment, is sometimes rendered more poetically and therefore less accurately, but perhaps more truthfully, as the glorious body of the Buddha. This is the archetypal Buddha form, the form in which the Buddha is perceived by advanced bodhisattvas dwelling on a much higher level of consciousness than that on which we usually function. This archetypal form of the Buddha is the form in which the bodhisattvas are said to enjoy the vision of the Buddha. For example, the form in which, as we have seen, the Buddha is said to be eternally preaching the White Lotus Sutra. The Sambhogakaya represents an archetypal richness of endowment beyond the limitations of any actual historical situation. In that sense, the archetypal Buddha is the Buddha beyond space and time, beyond history, but endowed with all the perfections of all the historical Buddhas and more. If you wanted to draw a perfect human being, the most beautiful human being conceivable, you probably wouldn't do your drawing from life. You might draw one person's eyes, another's hair, another's hands, to create an archetypally perfect human being. The archetypal Buddha, the Sambhogakaya Buddha, is similarly archetypally perfect, though on a much higher level. The Sambhogakaya has a number of aspects. The five principal ones are known as the five jinnas or five conquerors, or more simply, the five Buddhas, who, as we have seen, embody the five wisdoms of the enlightened mind. It is important to remember that they represent not the human historical Buddha, but different facets of this glorified or archetypal Buddha, existing on this archetypal plane, in between the plane we usually experience and the plane of absolute reality. The first of the jhanas is Varochana. His name means the illuminator, and as we have seen, he is sometimes also called the Great Sun Buddha, illuminating the whole spiritual cosmos, just as the sun illuminates its own physical solar system. He is a dazzling white colour, and his hands are in the teaching gesture, the Dharma Chakra Pravartana Mudra, the mudra of turning the wheel of truth. He holds in his hands an 8-spoked golden wheel, obviously a solar system, as well as being the traditional emblem for the Buddha's teaching. When Varochana is represented in a mandala, a circle of these archetypal forms, he usually occupies the central position. Second comes Akshobhya, the imperturbable, who is represented as being of a rich dark blue colour, like the midnight sky on a clear night in the tropics. His right hand is in the mudra called Bhumi Spasha, touching the earth, calling the earth to witness, and his emblem is the Vajra, Dorje in Tibetan, the diamond thunderbolt, the symbol of indestructible strength and power. The Vajra represents wisdom, the wisdom which smashes through ignorance, which destroys all error and illusion. Akshobhya is associated with the East. Third is Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born or jewel-producing. He is golden yellow in colour, and his right hand is in the Varada Mudra, the gesture of giving, especially giving the gift of the Dharma. His emblem is the jewel, and he is associated with the South. Fourth is Amitabha, the infinite light. Amitabha is a beautiful, deep, rich red, like the colour of the setting sun. His hands are in the meditation mudra, one hand simply resting upon the other. His emblem is the lotus, the symbol of spiritual rebirth, and he is associated with the western direction. Then fifthly and lastly comes Amoghasiddhi, unobstructed or infallible success. Amoghasiddhi is a dark green colour, and his right hand exhibits the gesture of fearlessness. His emblem is the double Dorje, 2 thunderbolts or 2 Vajras crossed, and he is associated with the north. These are the 5 chief aspects of the Sambhogakaya. There are hundreds more. All of them are archetypal, existing on this higher plane, intermediate between ordinary earthbound human consciousness and the level of ultimate absolute reality. So all of them are out of time as we usually experience it, without being out of time altogether. They occupy, as it were, a time scale different from that of our normal waking consciousness. We do sometimes come into contact with the archetypal world of the Sambhogakaya. Sometimes we touch the fringes of it in deep meditation, in archetypal dreams, or in aesthetic experience of a visionary nature. I referred to the archetypal bodhisattvas as bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya, but they could also be thought of as bodhisattvas of the Sambhogakaya. One cannot distinguish between form and no form. In their inner being, as it were, these bodhisattvas are at one with the Dharmakaya, but at the same time they manifest on the Sambhogakaya level. They are both Dharmakaya and Sambhogakaya, just as the Buddha himself, during his earthly lifetime, is Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. Bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya are those beings who have realized the Dharmakaya, but who, in a manner of speaking, continue to retain a Sambhogakaya form. The fact that they have a definite identity as bodhisattvas means that they belong to the Sambhogakaya realm. But the fact that they are bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya means that in manifesting that form, they do not depart from the Dharmakaya realm. If a bodhisattva, in addition to his Sambhogakaya form, assumes a Nirmanakaya form, he becomes an incarnate bodhisattva, or what the Tibetans call a tulku. But if he is a tulku in the full sense, he retains at least some experience of his Sambhogakaya and even his Dharmakaya status. Dharmakaya, as we have seen, is usually translated body of truth, but is more accurately rendered the aspect of absolute reality. The Dharmakaya represents Buddhahood as it is in itself, or the Buddha as he is in himself. The Dharmakaya therefore represents not the human historical Buddha, nor even the archetypal Buddha, but the real, true, genuine, ultimate Buddha. In two famous verses in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, "Those who by my form did see me, and those who followed me by voice, wrong the efforts they engaged in. Me those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddhas. From the Dharma bodies comes their guidance. Yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object." So the Buddha is not really his physical body, nor even his archetypal form. The Buddha is the Dharmakaya. The Buddha is reality. The message of the White Lotus Sutra is similar and even more explicit. We have seen that there are two modes of communication, one conceptual and abstract, the other the language of parable and myth. The White Lotus Sutra speaks predominantly in non-conceptual terms, and in it there is an episode which amply demonstrates the nature of the Dharmakaya. The scene is typical of a Mahayana sutra. There are thousands of the Buddha's disciples around, monks and nuns, lay people, arhants, bodhisattvas, together with non-human beings, dragons, celestial musicians, gods and fierce spirits, just the usual crowd. All manner of wonderful things have already occurred when something happens that completely astonishes even this assembly, accustomed as it has become to the miraculous. All of a sudden, millions of bodhisattvas appear out of the earth. But when the Buddha sees all these millions of bodhisattvas issuing from the fissures of the earth, he says, addressing his human disciples, "Ah yes, these are all my disciples. I've taught and trained them all." According to the sutra, and one can well imagine this, the ordinary human disciples express even more amazement. How can the Buddha possibly claim to have taught and trained all these millions of bodhisattvas who have appeared in this miraculous manner? They say, "But look here, you were enlightened only 40 years ago. We recognize that you've been working pretty hard, teaching all sorts of beings. You haven't wasted any time. But it's a bit much to ask us to believe that you've trained all these bodhisattvas. Some of them are not just ordinary novice bodhisattvas. They've been following the bodhisattva path for hundreds of lifetimes, thousands of years. How can they possibly be your disciples? It's like a young man of 25 pointing out a collection of centenarians and saying, 'They're all my sons.' It's impossible." At this point, the Buddha makes the great revelation towards which the whole sutra has been leading. He says, "Don't think that I was enlightened 40 years ago. That's just your way of looking at it. I am eternally enlightened." This obviously isn't the Nirmanakaya or the Sambhogakaya speaking. It's the Dharmakaya, the real Buddha, the eternal Buddha, Buddhahood itself, not any particular individual, however great. When the White Lotus Sutra speaks in terms of the eternal Buddha, one is not to understand the word eternal in the sense of indefinitely prolonged in time, but rather in the sense of being outside time altogether. Using this spatial term metaphorically, of course. For the White Lotus Sutra, as for the Diamond Sutra, The Buddha symbolizes the dimension of eternity, reality as existing beyond or outside time. And the Bodhisattva represents reality, even Buddhahood, as manifesting in time. As we have seen, the Bodhisattva follows the path, engages in certain activities, originates a progressive sequence of thoughts, words, and deeds. In other words, the Bodhisattva manifests the relative bodhicitta to an ever-increasing degree, and this process takes place in time. But we can take a broader view than this, to take in the Bodhisattva as symbolizing the whole process of life, evolving into ever higher forms. The Bodhisattva symbolizes both the lower evolution, the evolution from the very beginnings of life up to human beings in their unenlightened state, and the higher evolution, the evolution of human beings towards enlightenment. All this is one continuous process, or at least the process of the higher evolution arises in dependence upon the lower one. We see this kind of progression in the Jataka stories. As we've already seen, the Jatakas are one particular branch of Buddhist canonical literature, though there are also many non-canonical Jatakas, and they recount stories of the Buddha's previous lives, showing how, from life to life, the future Buddha advanced in the direction of enlightenment. Scholars have discovered that a number of these Jataka stories are old Indian folk tales that have been turned into Jatakas by the simple process of identifying the Buddha with the hero. It's as if we were to take Aesop's fables and identify Jesus with the principal character in each fable. This has occasioned a lot of discussion, especially as some of the folk tales are animal fables. Do Buddhists take all this quite literally? Are we to think that the hero, a hare or a deer or a lion or a goat, really represents the Buddha as he was in a previous life? In some parts of the Buddhist East, they do honestly regard the Jatakas as depicting the previous lives of the Buddha. But we need not take things so literally. The Jatakas clearly depict the evolutionary process. In each Jataka, there is a hero, a man or animal, who stands out as being more advanced than the rest, and who may therefore be said to represent a more advanced stage of evolution. It is significant that this hero is identified with the Buddha. The suggestion is that this figure represents that same evolutionary urge to develop, which ultimately resulted in the production of a Buddha. But while the end result is symbolized by the Buddha, the evolutionary urge itself is symbolized by the Bodhisattva. We thus have two principles, a principle of Buddhahood in the dimension of eternity, and a principle of Bodhisattvahood in the dimension of time. One is transcendent, the other is immanent. One represents perfection, eternally complete, eternally achieved. The other represents perfection eternally in the process of achievement. And the one does not lead into the other. The two are discontinuous. So is this the last word that can be said on the subject? Certainly not according to the Mahayana, and especially not according to the Tantra. There is no easy solution, though. We can't just say, time is illusory, merge it into eternity, or eternity is illusory, merge it into time. They are both irreducibly there. According to the Tantra, we need to realize both simultaneously. We need to see everything as eternally achieved, and at the same time, eternally in the process of achievement. The Buddha sits eternally beneath the Bodhi tree. He has always sat there, and he always will. At the same time, so to speak, the Bodhisattva is eternally practicing the perfections, life after life, to infinity. Buddha and Bodhisattva represent different aspects of one, the same, reality. It is this realization that constitutes the arising of the absolute bodhicitta. Not that there is any question of arising. The essence of the absolute bodhicitta is beautifully expressed in some Tibetan verses that form part of a practice known as the Confounder of Hell. The Confounder of Hell is one of the titles of Vajrasattva, and this particular practice is a form of Vajrasattva yoga. These verses give a very good idea, so far as one can have an idea at all, of the nature of the absolute bodhicitta. The mantra-like exclamation, "E ma o," with which they begin, is sometimes pronounced quickly as a single word. It often comes at the beginning of verses recited in the Tibetan tradition, as an expression of extreme wonder. Plato said that philosophy begins with a sense of wonder, and the same is true of the spiritual life. When one comes into contact with something transcendent, overwhelming, overpowering, one's reaction can only be one of wonder and astonishment. Each of the verses starts with this exclamation of wonder at the vision, as it were, of the absolute bodhicitta that is about to dawn. E ma o, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the birthless all things take their birth, yet in what's born there is no birth. E ma o, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the ceaseless all things cease to be, yet in that ceasing nothing ceases. E ma o, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the non-abiding all abides, yet thus abiding there abideth naught. E ma o, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In non-perception everything's perceived, yet this perceiving's quite perceptionless. E ma o, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In the unmoving all things come and go, yet in that movement nothing ever moves. This is an expression of the essence, as far as it can be expressed, of the absolute bodhicitta. Here we have, juxtaposed in a single vision, blended without confusion, reality as existing out of time, in eternity, and reality as progressively revealed in time. It is difficult to go beyond this point, or even reach it, even in our imagination. But that doesn't mean that the absolute bodhicitta is too rarefied and remote for us to bring it into our practice, at least to some extent. To begin with, we have to realize that however long time goes on, it never reaches eternity. Time does not go beyond time. It just goes on and on. Consequently, there is no question of getting any nearer to the absolute, any nearer to Buddhahood, which is in the dimension of eternity. In a million years, we will be no nearer to eternity or to enlightenment than we are now. This isn't as hopeless as it sounds. We can turn it the other way round and say that at this very moment, we are as close to enlightenment as we shall ever be. Even a bodhisattva on the very threshold of enlightenment is no nearer to it than we are right now. Every moment is the last moment, whether it's this moment or the next, or a moment occurring in a million years' time. And beyond the last moment, there's only Buddhahood. So at every moment, although we don't know it, and if we did know it, what a terrible reaction there would be, we find ourselves at the top of the flagpole, and all we have to do is, well, what? We have come a long way, at least in imagination, we have completed our journey along the bodhisattva path. At the same time, we haven't gone anywhere. Likewise, the goal of the journey is eternally achieved, and eternally in the process of being achieved. The Buddha and the Bodhisattva, eternity and time, are one, or are not two. With that insight, we come to the end, or perhaps the beginning, of our exploration of the Bodhisattva ideal.